here with Tyler. We are just coming off the Final Four. We had a coach workshop and a player clinic. I really enjoyed spending the time in Phoenix with Tyler and his family and all the coaches and players that came out. I think the weekend was really successful, and it was built around playing point five, teaching players to shoot it, drive it, or move it, and the decision-making process behind that. Tyler, I'm going to throw it to you here. What were your big takeaways from the weekend as far as the workshop or the clinic goes?
Players shoot the ball better when they have to shoot it faster. You know, I think they're, you know, many players are enamored with the idea of getting their shot off quicker. And I think they're enamored with this idea because they think, oh, I'm going to get a bunch of more shots if I can just speed up my release. The gains that come from like physically or technically improving the speed of your shot are not nearly as great as the gains that come from mentally improving the speed of your shot. And so I think that's just a great reminder for us as coaches and how we actually train players is if we can actually teach speed of shot by changing the order of decision-making, as opposed to let's physically improve the time it takes us to lift and release the basketball. So one might get like 0.2 seconds of improvement if they work on the speed of lifting and firing the basketball, 0.2 seconds, which is so small that it will have very little to no impact on how many shots one gets off. But if one actually changes the order at which their players decide to shoot, like most players, and we talked about this in our workshop, and we went kind of deep in this, and Mark did a great job giving actual ways to train this, and we actually trained in our player workshop, which is great. Most players catch, read, execute. And when you catch, read, and then execute, it is a question of seconds. Like how many seconds, 1 to 2 seconds between the catch and the shot. Whereas if one reads, catches, executes, that's how you actually take 1 to 2 seconds off of the time it takes you to shoot. So that's step one. And step two is that creates the expectation to shoot in one's mind when they shoot faster because of the read, not shoot faster because of the physical manipulation of body and ball. Players just shoot better. We've got a player here locally by the name of Malia. We've been working on her three-point shooting from an accuracy standpoint. She has not been shooting it well for weeks because we've been tuning her shot and has felt frustration. And I've been working with her for weeks to help develop her shot. Mark goes in on Sunday in our player clinic and just gets her to shoot faster without thinking about it. And she shoots better than she has in 2 weeks, which is a great reminder to me. It's like I get so enamored with like the too often with the tuning of the technique of player shot. Whereas if you can just get someone to shoot faster, it smooths out all the rough edges of technique, like the starts and stops or hitches a player might have in their shot or thumb manipulation, all that stuff. Like if you just speed up their shot, the ball is going to find the path of least resistance. Like the shortest distance between 2 points is a straight line. And if players have too many curves or arcs in their lift and fire, just give them to shoot faster and it smooths out and tightens up their technique without actually focusing on technique. So that was my biggest takeaway from what Mark taught us and what we did in our player and coach workshop. Because if you get players to shoot better, you're going to score more points. If you score more points, you win more games. You win more games, you have more fun.
Yeah. And we're doing a whole cohort on this week. So we could talk about this the whole time, but I do want to touch on a couple of things you said. So speed up the shot. What resonates with me when you say that is I think players will find their natural shot. I know whenever I try to shoot in a certain way, it just feels weird. And I think if players can find their natural shot where they focus more on just functional movement, then we can, maybe you have some thoughts on this, but then we can start to modify small tweaks within their natural shot instead of trying to build their shot a certain way. And then what stood out to me too is just the importance of having players that play decisive, fast, and free. So decisive would be read closeout before the catch. I am going to read my defender and decide if I'm immediately into my shot, immediately into my drive, or if I'm clicking it right away. And then we want to train the technical aspect or our skills so we can execute those quickly. And we saw that in the player clinic. You actually made a really good point when we were in our drive it section. You were able to see that players were catching, then deciding the drive. So to get their feet coordinated faster on their drive into that go step or split step we were teaching, and then playing free, which would be unlock them to make plays. It's okay to make the wrong decision at times. That's not the ultimate killer. Indecision would be the worst decision. But clearly defining roles, ideally every player could shoot it, drive it, or move it, but that's not reality, right? NBA teams don't have five players on the court that can shoot it, drive it, or move it. So what is my go-to? Like, what am I always hunting? I know for me, and you probably picked this up when we played 3-on-3 FIBA, it had been a while since I played, so I wasn't hunting twos as much as I was ones, because that's just what I was more comfortable with in the moment. So ball in the air, I was kind of thinking drive it, but if I read like, okay, I've got a seven here, I need to take this, I almost reverse my order a little bit, which you can do for players, but the initial framework or kind of the base framework would be shoot it, drive it, or move it. So we're never wasting the closeout.
Which is why it was so fun being on your team, because I was shoot it first. And you just drove, collected D, and just let me shoot threes, which I love. That's all I want to do in my life. I appreciate that. Okay, I think this is key. I'm going to mark this clip. Another observation in actually bringing coaches out to the player clinic that is a little bit uncomfortable for most coaches, but I think more effective if you exercise the three O's when organizing your player development drills. So these are the three O's. This is how we do things at Savvy, and this is probably a discomfort to lean into. And it's really the difference between a good coach and a master teacher. And here's the three O's in order: objective, organize, observe. Objective, organize, observe. Most too many good coaches will pre-teach the read, the skill, the technique. That is less effective than just sharing our objective. Worst decision is indecision. Let's make a quick and assertive decision. That's our objective here. Move off it. Organize. Offense at the top of the key, defense with their toes on the free throw line, pass comes from the smile. Defense, as soon as you see the ball, you're live. Go. We just organized. You notice there was no actual teaching there. Like, there was no technique, there was no read, nothing. All of the teaching comes in the third O, which is observe and provide the most effective feedback per the individual, per what you see. And I think both Mark and I have leaned into this because our experience is different than most coaches. Most coaches are coaching one team with the same group of players over a long period of time. And so you're experts in knowing what your team needs or thinking you know what your team needs. Whereas Mark and I, as clinicians, like, we've had to be able to walk into a gym, diagnose, assess, observe, and say, here is the thing that's going to get us the most traction right now with a blank slate. And a lot of times our predisposed assumptions when we have the same team are actually our blind spots. And so I think coming in with a fresh eye and a fresh lens to actually observe, okay, what do our players, our team in this moment need? That's what Mark shared that I did, is like, he set up the objective. He organized the game. We went, I observed a thing. And then I gave the teaching after we had been going for a period of time, 3, 4, 5 minutes. And then that thing unlocked a whole nother level. And so that's why I said that's the difference between a good coach and a master teacher. Is a good coach can probably set up a good drill, a good environment that's going to provide a little bit of improvement. But a master teacher is going to actually be able to hit on the thing in the way after we're flowing that's going to unlock the next level faster. So I'll repeat it. Clearly state the objective. organize the environment, the constraint, the game, whatever that's going to provide the reps that are going to get you better at the objective, and then sit back and observe is the third thing. And the more you develop your lens and check your lens against those of other experts and master teachers, that's really where the nuance and the improvement comes.
Yeah, I'm going to highlight a couple things that you talked about within that. So organize, I think you said offense at the top of the key. Defense, stand here when you see the ball close out. I love that you limited it to three teaching points, right? Rule of 3, 10, 30. And like you said, no technical teaching there. I think, especially when you're introducing a new drill, let's just get them going in the drill. Because as a player, you're going to have to think about, okay, well, what did Tyler just say? I stand here. When I see the ball, I close out. And then if we're giving them all these technical aspects of a closeout or how to drive the closeout, we're giving them a lot to think about. Our teaching point there was seven or hunt. That's it. And we didn't care about the footwork of the drive or the finish necessarily, or even the close off. Really, we just told them, if you force offensive player to dribble, you win defense. Like, just that would be the win for the defense there. So we weren't closing out short and in building, you know, poor habits. And we were given the offensive player a seven or hunt read. So really, really good.
And then, Mark, let me also give this reminder. What Mark just did, seven or hunt, is an example of if-then statements. And one of the things that Mark did really well in our coach workshop was provide a list of if-then statements. When observing, I would encourage you to observe the issue and provide the if-then statement. The best thing that we can do is provide less if-then statements in more context over the course of a practice. So last night, our if-then statement was, if no nine, pass for seven. And I said that probably 80 times throughout the course of multiple games, multiple situations, because offense is just shot selection and defense is just influencing shot selection. So we didn't need to teach a new principle. We just needed to provide more context, more examples, more experiences where we applied that same principle in order to learn. And so, I mean, that was just a great example of, like, once you observe, provide an if then that's a principle that you're trying to apply, as opposed to use this technique.
I think what the if then statements do as well is they make decisions easier by just creating a read, right? If no seven, then hunt. If no nine, then look pass for a seven. I think you do a really nice job of this. I'll put you on the spot here. And then I've got one more thing to say about the player clinic. Tell me the difference between a decision and a read.
Speed. So, like, gosh, man, I don't know if I should marry this girl. It's a big decision. Big decision. Let me talk to all my friends. Let me make a pro con list. Let me check my heart. You know, let me pray. Whatever, right? It takes time. Decisions take time, right? Where, like, a read is instantaneous. Green light, go, right? Red light, stop. I don't have to actually think about it. So I believe that the process of learning is turning decisions into reads. I mean, you could ask a player, and I've actually done this with large groups at camps. Say I've got 100 players. I'll say, okay, you have a choice to make here. You can choose to pass the ball to your own team or to pass the ball to the other team. Okay. Raise your hand if you'd like to pass the ball to your own team. Everyone raise your hand. Right, exactly, right? Good decision. Now, raise your hand if you've ever passed the ball to the other team. Every hand also goes up. It's not yet a read, right? It's not yet a read. Because at speed, we still can't make the read perfectly. So decisions and reads aren't a lack of information. It's a lack of execution. And that's what we're actually repping out in training, is trying to move decisions to reads more often.
Love it. Really good. All right. So you mentioned the coaches being there. I thought it was an incredible value to the coaches that observed. And it provided, like you said, we're clinicians. We go in and we're tasked with teaching players something in a short amount of time. It was really cool to see that all come together. I mean, we had one player from Idaho and one player from Wyoming there that walked in not knowing anything that we were going to teach. And by the end, we're playing some really, really good 0.5 basketball. So
in less than 3 hours.
In less than 3 hours, absolutely.
Yeah, which is a question we often get. And oh gosh, how much can you actually teach in 2 days? Everything. Like I am continually blown away, as are the coaches that we work with. And I don't feel like any arrogance in saying this, like just because it's happened so often. Honestly, it's just a fact. Like in 2 days, coaches, and we actually have a bunch that have jumped on live here from the community, post Mark, coaches, in 2 days, you can see your whole program play very different basketball. And that's what we do. And in fact, in your courtside chat, I'll just share this. Like one coach was like, hey, we got a little gift from Boosters. What can we get? I texted Mark. I'm like, Mark, like, I feel a little bit like self-promoting, but like I said, I want to say they should do a program clinic or a team camp. And it's just because based on what I know, I don't know of a better investment of a few thousand dollars for an actual impact on your season and program than bringing us in. I'm sure that there are other clinicians that could do this as well. I just don't know what they're going to teach, but I do know that it's better than a Vertimax or a NOAA machine that'll talk to you about your arc. And so that's just, again, a reminder. We want to come work with your program, because of the impact that we can have.
Yeah. Agreed. Anytime you have resources, put them towards things that directly impact winning. And program clinic would not only impact your players, but I think it impacts you as a coach and your coaching staff to where you're now equipped to pay that forward. So yeah, really cool to see the skill of 0.5 come together in those 3 hours. If you weren't able to make it, we have it videoed. Tyler and I were mic'd up. We're going to put it in the resources. It'll be available for all Grow and Courtside members. And then maybe to kind of bring this home and segue here, question I got in an email. They heard me on a podcast recently talking about off-season stuff. And the question was about summer practices. How do I plan summer practices? I've got a lot of new players. Actually, this coach was going into a new program. So all new players and all new coaches as well. And I told him to focus on 0.5 because it doesn't matter. You don't have to know an offensive system in order to teach 0.5. And you're actually that's going to give you a framework to develop your players. So when the ball's in the air, if I'm thinking to shoot it, okay, what do we have to work on? We got to work on shooting. And if I don't have a 7, now I'm going to hunt. So we've got to work on how to drive the ball, how to attack a closeout, how to stop, how to finish. And if none of those are available, we pass. So now we work on passing and the read on when I pass or when I shoot. So that gives you kind of an order of operations for your skill development, but also just as important, you're working on advantage basketball, which you should work on more than your create actions. So that was my advice to this coach was, you're going to start developing your players. You're going to start developing your offensive system, and you're going to start to teach your language that you're going to start using in that program. So that would be the first one to tackle. Anything to kind of add with summer practices for this coach?
No.
Okay.
And that's the first time I've said that to you.
Love it.
All right. I've got another question. And this question was a little confusing to me. So I'll throw it out to you first, and then I'm not sure if we're answering it correctly, but we'll see what happens. Here's the question. What development would you do to work offensively on players who attack on the weak side without talking about screening? What would be the main skills to work on, and how would you work on them? How are you interpreting that question?
I'm thinking moving, either occupying defense on the weak side, or that was first thing that came to mind, or just maybe general spacing, like off somebody hunting. Just how would we, so if we're not gonna, I guess he's saying we're not gonna screen on the backside. So What am I missing here? Would that just be an exchange or just relocating and changing your positioning?
Maybe, yeah. And that's it. And so I just kind of interpreted that question. Maybe I'll answer it for me and you can answer it for you and we'll see if it serves Coach David here. So I'm interpreting that question on what are you teaching players to do opposite the ball? And how would you develop them to be better for better in your offense opposite the basketball? So I think you started getting to maybe one for you, Marcus, exchange. I'm going to leave that one alone. So let me take my, here's my three steps for developing how a player is going to work off the ball better, all players. And then Mark, you can take it as well. Three steps. First, one principle. If a player is working off the ball, they're probably not one of our primary playmakers. I would encourage all coaches, and this is what we've attempted to do with our transition roles and races face. I would encourage all coaches to attempt to create a system or processes that keeps the ball in your best players' hands more. The same is true in all sports. I'm on this pickleball journey right now, and so it's very relevant to me. But when playing doubles pickleball, the whole goal of higher level pickleball is to have the better partner touching the ball more. That's it. That's how you win, right? And so there's lots of systems one can put in place. You can stack. Mark got to learn a little bit about that. You generally put the stronger player's forehand to the middle so that they can take 2/3 of the court. It's just a system to get your better player touching the ball more. It's the same thing in offense. You want to create a system that gets your better players touching the ball more. There's lots of ways to do that. All love to my friend Rick Torbett. It's my biggest bone that I've picked with Read and React. Is it's essentially an equal opportunity system. And I think that's the biggest weakness of continuity offense, is it's an equal opportunity system. And you don't have as many dials to turn in order to get the ball in your best player's hands the most. Okay, so that's the principle. We want the ball in our best player's hands the most.
So pickleball, I was able to play with Tyler this week in Phoenix. And we had two types of games. We had really competitive games where we were playing with higher level players. And then we had lower level games where we were playing with players that were less experienced. And I was a less experienced player. So tell me if this is right, Tyler, in our more competitive games, we stacked to keep you on the left side. So you had 2/3 of the court. That was more war games. And then when we played lower level, I would say, hey, we stack. And you're like, no, like just, let's just play and give you an opportunity to play on both sides. And so that was one example of sandboxing war games, which came up this weekend. But also, it allowed me to develop just by playing the game. Like, I got so much better in 3 or 4 days at pickleball.
You did.
We didn't do any drills, right? Like, you taught me through the game where if there was a ball that I should have gotten or maybe I shouldn't have gotten, you just gave me feedback and I just kept welcoming feedback. And just by playing the game, I got better, which would be another pro or another argument for games-based approach to teaching.
It's so interesting, the parallels across all sports. Yes, to all of the stuff that you said. And I'll share this now before I go into the three things I do on the weak side. Probably the preeminent pickleball coach in the world. He coaches all of the top pros. He coaches one of my friends that is a pro. I've gotten to sit in on some of his coaching sessions. He actually just, he's a savvy coach. He's a savvy pickleball coach. He and I had a conversation actually yesterday about these things, but he recently made a post because there were many lower level pickleball coaches that were throwing shade at him, saying that he doesn't teach technique and doesn't work on skill development. And he basically fired back and said, it's not that I don't teach technique or that I don't think it's important to teach technique. He said, I would just never teach it first, which I think is a great, I mean, did I send you that clip, Mark? Is that a clip I sent you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
which I think is a great framework for us and coaches in basketball as well, which is what Mark is referring to. It's like, no, we at Savvy absolutely believe in teaching technique. We just don't believe in teaching it first. That's part of the observation, and you determine, is that the thing that they need? But it's not what they need first. What they need first is game context with a clear objective. Objective, organization, go. Observe, what do they need? And usually what they need first is not technique. What they need first is to move from decision-making to reads. That's what they need first. In all contexts, action, advantage, transition, defense, rebounding, like all scenarios. And then where you get the slight gains at the end is going to be technique. So that's, again, just all for context. Mark, anything else before I go into the three things that I would teach someone on the weak side?
Nope. Shoot.
Okay. They're on the weak side because they're not one of your primary playmakers in a war game situation. That's why they're there. And so that informs what we want them to do, right? So the number one thing that players need to learn when they're on the weak side or away from the ball is just to hold their space. Just hold their space. And that's a skill because everyone wants to cut. Is that what you wrote down as well?
That was my number one.
Yep. Number one. I can't tell you how many times I asked this question of players last night. Why are you cutting? Why are you cutting? Either cutting or moving and creeping inside of the three-point line. It is a skill to learn to play in space outside the three-point line. It's a skill that must be developed. It's a skill that most young players don't have because it's not how they start learning the game. They're developing habits when they're very young to be as close to the basket as they can because that's where they can score from and everybody wants to score. Which on the flip side, if you talk about long-term athlete development, it's why I believe in teaching shooting first at a very young age and teaching shooting as power generation as opposed to anything else so that they can shoot from further at a young age. Because if they can shoot from further at a young age, they will play from where they can shoot from. If they play from where they can shoot from, which is further away from the rim, they're going to start to develop good habits that will unlock every other aspect of basketball. So Mark has gotten to see my daughter, Charlie. She's 8 years old. She can shoot from three. I would say not effortlessly, but functionally. She can shoot from three at eight. And I believe that that's possible for anyone because all we focused on with her is power generation. Can you just get the ball there? Then it's fun for her to play there. And now she can learn to make reads from there. And if you can't play there and make reads from there, then you're going to get limited context for the future and higher level basketball. Which is also my argument why I think that lower level basketball must be played with smaller balls and lower goals, because that then allows players to play from further away, which is going to get them to play basketball earlier, not whatever you call what most people are doing at the youth level that is not basketball. Hold space. Let's popcorn. This is fun. Go ahead. I know yours was space as well, but any other pieces on that?
Yeah. Maybe this is a principle to think about is or a concept. Is spacing versus standing. Mm-hmm. So we can be standing on the court and be right or wrong, right? If I'm standing on an X, if I'm standing in a spot, if I'm giving space, standing is okay. I think a lot of traditional coaching is on offense, we got to move, right? In order to punish the defense. So that might be something that you use for some sticky language or a concept to teach your players. Spacing versus standing. Both can, standing can be good or bad depending on your positioning. I'll go next with my second one that I wrote down, would be burn. So if I'm not going to hold space, I guess really second could be adjust positioning.
No, I like that you said burn because that's what I wrote down too. So,
okay. Yeah. But burn is a way to adjust your positioning. Right. If we're on the weak side, let's say I'm at the 45 and you're in the corner, if the corner burns, now maybe I slide down to the corner, or if the 45 burns, maybe I rise behind the burn because that burn cut's going to create gravity. And if the burn cut's not open, we've got to kick for a seven. That would be mine. Hold space, number one, burn two.
Yeah. And I do want to link these to what the ball is doing, or I would link these to what the ball is doing. We hold first so the ball can hunt. We burn second when the ball triggers a protection plan. So like most players when hunting are not going to be able to actually read and see advantageous passes. And so I primarily want players to hold space and allow the ball to hunt a nine first. If no nine, because I try to link up what the ball is doing and what players off the ball are doing in the most simple way. For on ball hunts, if no nine, protection plan. So we have a whole menu of protection plans, but protection plans unlock what Mark was saying is like movement or relocation or whatever, which I think the first step of that is just bird cuts. You know, we can have unlocks and lifts and all this other stuff, which is good. But I would say that for me, they're second order pieces. First order is second burn, hold first, burn second. And that is your order of operation. And it's all triggered by what the ball is doing. If offense can become relationships to the ball, as opposed to relationships to four other players, it's going to be a lot less fragile and a lot more unbreakable. If all five players need to be doing something that is in relationship to each other, one person doesn't do their job and it breaks. But if we have four player relationships to the ball, well, three people cannot do what they're supposed to do, but one person does, and we have an anti-fragile offense. It's unbreakable. So as often as you can, if you can break things down to relationships to the ball between two players and then actions that might involve two or three players, that's how you can get an unbreakable offense as opposed to five-player continuity. So hold first, burn second. And then I went really simple on my third, and I'm very interested to see what your third one is. Crash third. Crash the offensive boards. Which is like, because it's just how I think a weak side player is going to actually get involved, right? So you hold your space first, let the ball hunt. You burn second after the ball hunts, and you crash third when a shot is taken, probably by someone on the strong side of the floor. And that's how you get involved.
Yeah. Man, I love the crash one. I love it. Because we were actually talking offensive rebounding watching the Final Four game. So I might actually adjust my three, because when I put my third one, I think my third one may even come before burn.
Okay.
Hold space one, burn three.
Okay.
My second would be just adjust position, because if we're holding space, but we are three in a row, meaning it is ball, defender, me, I've got to move to find an open window. So on that hunt, I'm making myself available for a seven.
Mm-hmm.
As I adjust my position, now I read burn. So that might be my order of operations.
Yeah, agreed. Which is an argument for zooming out a little bit on second and just have it as the bucket adjust, knowing that like shaping up or burning are menu options within that. Yeah, agreed. Hold, right. Adjust, crash. Yeah, go ahead.
I've got a question here that was asked, and I think this coach was asking in the spirit of getting ideas, but the question was framed, coaches, I'm asking for a template for a team motto, a discipline system, and team goals. I don't think there's a template for that, maybe a system for developing those. So I'll touch on all three first. Feel free to interject. And then if you just want to touch on all three or one, or you can as well. Team motto. I find in the off season, coaches tend to find, the good coaches are always trying to learn more material, right? They're trying to invest in themselves and learn more, which is awesome. Know that you can get all the ideas, but use very few. And sometimes we see a really cool team motto, or maybe we see what UConn's was and say, hey, well, they won a national championship. That team motto is what we're going to adopt. I would actually argue against that. I think that's the wrong order. What I would do is let's talk more about standards, right? Behaviors, who we want to be as a team. Spend your off season developing your standards and behaviors, and then at the end of your off season, maybe it's at the end of your June season when a lot of coaches are playing games and practicing, ask your team, hey, who were we? If we were going to zoom out and look back at our you know, April, May, June, what defined us, what behaviors defined us, or what standards were we above the line on? And then what team motto fits that? Because that is who you are. And then that is what you are trying to take from good to great, maybe. So I would maybe reverse the order there instead of coming up with the motto and then trying to fit to that motto. As far as, let's go to team goals, same thing. I would actually say use process goals and not end goals, right? Goals that are oriented around success or winning, right? Like what team doesn't want to win a state championship? What team doesn't want to win a conference or a district title? Everybody has the same goals. It's what you do leading up to that. So I would look at it as, what is the obstacle? Like, why aren't we a championship program right now? And those become your process goals or your standards for your program. And then last, discipline. We could probably go for a whole another hour's episode or even a cohort on discipline. But my response was, our goal for discipline should be to build character and strengthen relationships. We want to have a transformational approach rather than a transactional approach of, I caught you doing something wrong, you're going to run, and now we're even. And we actually had a friend of ours present at our Final Four workshop, and he talked about repairing their relationships, which we call restorative, right? Consequences. So we enforce our standards. There's discipline. Doesn't have to be running. But then how do we repair that? Because I think too often it's the formula. You messed up, I discipline you, now we're even. So I think the number one advice would be to establish standards. And most coaches, I think, do that, whether intentionally or unintentionally. Second thing I would say is, be relentless and consistent and have great follow-up in supporting and enforcing those standards. So it comes from a place of building character and strengthening relationships, and you're equipping players with the values that you're trying to instill with them within your program.
Yeah, really well said. Not much to add other than this thought. I think it's worth considering discipline as an impact to relationship and really leaning into that. You know, discipline can be some sort of external consequence. I mean, think of it as simple as, you know, if you choose to spank your child, okay? What I have found and am still learning even as a parent is the most heavy and painful consequence that I can deliver as a parent is communicating the impact of one of my children's decisions on our relationship and the level of trust that I have for them. You know, and so, like, you know, one of my daughters can, you know, choose to disobey and have a rebellious attitude through their disobedience, and I can give them the consequence. Or they can disobey, have a rebellious attitude through that disobedience, and then hours or days later, they can ask to do something, or we can be talking and I can communicate, that choice really degraded my trust in your maturity, and therefore I don't feel like I can trust you to make good decisions alone at your friend's house. And it's hurt this trust relationship that we have. And that's a lot more weighty, I have found, than just delivering a consequence in the moment. It's not that, you know, and of course we're all learning as parents and doing an incredibly imperfect job, or at least I am. But I'm leaning into that and learning that, the stronger my trust relationship and respect relationship is with my kids, the more they want to elevate that relationship and protect that relationship. And so therefore they'll stay away from behaviors that they know damage that relationship. I think it's the same for a coach and their players. The more your players value their relationship with you, the more they'll want to protect and elevate that relationship. And the more you can clearly communicate to them your standards, which is just saying, hey, here is how you build trust. Here's how you strengthen relationship with me and with your teammates. These are the behaviors that do that. And here's the behaviors that degrade that relationship, that trust, that bank account, right? Deposits and withdrawals. And the more you can help educate them what makes deposits in that trust relationship, and the more they can really feel the loss of that relationship. And in one way, I mean, playing time equals trust, right? So one, your strongest, I think, you know, consequence really is playing time, and playing time equals trust. So I think the more you can link that to relationship, and even remove it from if then consequences, right? If you don't uphold our standards, then you don't get to go on this trip or whatever, but just really have like the relational conversation. I think that will help people hold the line of your standards more.
Yeah. And with talking about consequences, when you have rules, it's the if then, right? You did this, so now this is the consequence. I always encourage coaches to make consequences progressive, where shift your mindset first. If somebody is late or somebody doesn't show up for a practice, your initial thought should be, is everything okay? Mm-hmm. Right? Like, let's come from a posture of like, not, oh, they did this to me, they're a problem, but maybe they have a problem, right? Maybe something came up. Second thing is just consequences should be progressive. We don't have to come out like a fire hose and just have a binary, you know, like you did this, so this. I think everything is unique and different. Every situation is. So can we use conversations? Can we be curious before we're judgmental to, you know, help resolve the issues and to help change behavior? Right. And oftentimes that is removing the obstacle for the player. So if something's going on, there's probably an obstacle that's in the way of them operating at standard. So how can we help the player and equip the player to remove that obstacle? So the issue or the problem goes away, and it's not something that we have to coach against or navigate against the rest of the season or the rest of their career.
Yeah. Excellent. Did you have something to go to next, Mark?
Nope, that's it.
All right. We're getting some questions about zone offense. And one of our savvy coaches, Kevin Krieger, actually sent me some film of them running some of our race and space zone actions against zone defense. But I think what you'll see here is advantage basketball and the goal to create advantage catches. So let's dive into it right here. I think this, we can probably pull some of this out even and put into our zone action and share with our coaches. So let me just see if I can get this screen up. Mark, let me know when you're able to see that screen.
Got it.
Cool. All right, so three principles of offense, but then I think we apply directly to zone offense even more directly. Would be one, hunt nines first. Zone defenses are uniquely designed to make it harder to get nines, but that doesn't mean we stop hunting them. So that puncture or that cracking of the shell is not going to result in as many nine attempts, but it is essential in order to create advantage. And so what most teams do against the zone too often is they just continue to trim the edges and they forget to hunt, they forget to dribble. So don't forget to hunt. Now, how we hunt and how we hunt nines is going to be a little bit more off the pass than off the dribble against the zone, but that's principle number one. So let's go ahead and let's explore that principle visually here first, and then we'll go into our other principles as well. So we're again, this team in white, this is Kevin's team, and they're going against a 2-3 zone here. So you see they arrive in shape. Still, they're going 4-out-1-in alignment. Beautiful. So what they're going to do, they have no advantage. We arrive neutral here. So we have to create an advantage. So the action that they're utilizing to create their advantage is going to be what we call our porch series, one of the options out of porch series, just like rose series has three primary options with their inverses. Porch series has the same. Porch series you can find in Race and Space. We're going to do a mini series out of it because so many coaches want to go deeper into zone actions. But one of the porch series is just flank and burn. All right. So we play through the porch. There's an example playing through the porch. You can step all the way out to the corner if he wants. This is called flank and burn. When the ball does hit the porch, we immediately just make a burn cut from the 45. So that's his burn. Now we can find it, but at least that is occupying. You see that we've occupied four defenders in really small space. And what we're attempting to do with our flank and burn is we're attempting to create a domino catch on the weak side on this two out. That's all we're trying to do. On this two out, we want to get a domino catch that we can try to attack in some way. Let's see if they do. Okay. Don't on the first one, no problem. So we just flank and burn again. You can do it on either side of the floor. Okay, beautiful. So this would be the next, I guess we are going to the second one because we're seeing it here. The next option out of our porch series is just going to be our dance. So if we don't actually get a pass to the porch, so here you see the porch stepping out here, we don't actually pass to the porch. And the porch can go short corner or step up to deep corner or lift out of the corner. We just want to use that player. But if we don't actually hit the porch, then the porch goes into a dance. A dance is like a flash into the middle of the zone. So there we actually do hit him on the flash, and so we get a domino catch off of that. Good shooter read right there. So action one off of porch series is going to be flank and burn. Option two is going to be our dance. Let's see what they do here. Again, we arrive neutral. Okay, there we hit the porch. Now that's more in short corner catch, right? So there he goes into his flank and burn. And the burn cut might get you some catches inside the arc. But even more importantly, you see that it occupies the defense and creates 11 here. He's got a wide open domino catch if we see him. It's fine. We don't get it. But we do get into dominoes. And that's a really good seven for us. I think one point that I would like to make for coaches right now is oftentimes against a 2-3 zone, we understand that the high post is an area of weakness and we tend to plant someone there. The two tweaks that I found really successful would be, one, don't leave someone there still. Don't just have them standing there following the basketball. It becomes really easy to guard. And two, go there second and not first. And that's why we kind of go order of operation with flank and burn first and dance second. And the reason we call it a dance instead of a flash is because when you dance, you want to dance in and out. We don't want to stay there. We only pass the ball to an offensive player moving towards you. We never pass the ball to an offensive player moving away or standing still. So you dance towards the ball. And if you don't get the ball as you're dancing, you're immediately dancing out. Right? It's kind of like a sombrero hat dance or a Mexican hat dance. In and out, in and out, in and out. Let's see one or two more possessions before we go into our, that's what we want to get first as our first action to start our dominoes or advantage games. We do want to play through the porch first. It tends to flatten out the defense and give us a numbers advantage on the top half of the floor, right? So we're going to get right there. You'll see, especially if 11 were to hold a space, and 11 is actually getting into the third read of the porch series, which is 45 dive. And that would actually ideally happen after the burn cut, would be our 45 dive. If the burn occupies, we then will go to our 45 dive, to then again, crack the shell. So that'd be the three reads of the porch series. Pretty nice job on the 45 dive. This is what we'd call an 8 on the shot scale, right? There's bodies in the paint with you. So you play off of 2 feet, and the goal of an 8 is to try to get the defense in the air and create contact on the finish, which he does here. We call that an 8 read. All right, Mark, I'll kind of let this play in the background. I can pause. Any additional thoughts on these zone actions, porch series, zone offensive principles?
Yeah. I really liked how they hunted sevens there off the pass to the porch, right? So what I would say is against man defense, when we're neutral, we use create actions, right? That might be a ghost or a zoom or something out of Rose series. In this situation, our create action is simply just thrown into the porch.
Right.
It flattens the D. It might even bring two to the ball like we saw, and that's enough to create advantage. So I don't think you need to run anything intricate against the zone to create advantages. It's more about just getting two to the ball or flattening the D, and like you said, creating advantage on the perimeter.
Nothing pauses right there, Mark, because here's a great example, just so everybody can see it. And this is what your eyes, I think as a well-prepared coach or a savvy team, your eyes should light up when you see two things. One, press, two, zone. I think both of those things actually create for us the things that we have to work hard to create against a man, which is interesting because I think that most teams that I've worked with actually feel more confident in their man offense than they do in their zone offense, or they get a little tight against pressure. And so the first step is to actually change your mindset around it. But like, if you play the same way against man and zone, you will be frustrated. Against zone, light pressure, you just have to use what the defense is predisposed to against them. They're going to give you dominoes. You have to allow them to give it to you. And the way that most, especially 2-3 defenses, are structured is playing through the porch. Why we use porch series against zone will bring two to the ball or create dominoes catches. Here's an example, then I'll throw it back to you, Mark. Right? Just by throwing it to the porch, there it is. We have two to the ball. Right? There are two to the ball. So we allow it. Whereas the worst thing you can do against a 2-3 is just over dribble. And dribble against one. Allow the passes to bring two to the ball. Really good flank and burn right there. And now we're into like the whole defense is over. It's compromised right here. We've got the ball inside the shell. We have two on the ball. We've got, you know, wide open sevens on the weak side with some decision making to be able to get some nine. Oh, look at that. Okay, beautiful. I didn't know that was going to happen. Okay, with the ability to get nines, which is really hard against the zone.
Yeah. So bringing two defenders to the ball, sticky language we use, you could use it against man or zone. We use it against zone more so, but make two take, meaning make two defenders take you. How do you do that? By aligning yourself in a, what we call a gray area, right? The porch is a gray area. We're not on the block. We're not in the long corner. So right now we're getting the middle of the zone and the forward of the zone both taking the ball, which gives us advantage. You said something really good. If you play the same way against a zone as you do man, you're going to be really frustrated. I would agree, because against zone, you need less player movement and create actions. And I would prioritize, not that we don't in man, verse man, but I would prioritize spacing and ball movement above everything.
Yeah.
So spacing would be really our positioning on the court. We align ourselves in the gray area. We want to make triangles as offensive players. So I'm the top of the triangle and I've got two defenders as my, you know, bottom of the triangle. I'm aligning in a gray area where I get my catch. I'm forcing a bump in rotation where I make two take, which is going to increase space somewhere else. And then we just prioritize ball speed. Can ball movement create a, like we saw here, flatten the D, bring two, or create a closeout that we can drive and now play out of dominoes with? So I would say number one for me would be spacing and ball movement above anything. And that's how we would hunt nines first, right? And then what we called that playtime. Like when you go to kindergarten, they all have toys out there and you got to learn how to share. And the best way to do that is just play and figure it out. Right. So we called it playtime, where our number one goal was to generate ball speed to create advantage. And then the dance and flash is a kind of a series, which we could run the porch series. It would be our share in space. So now we've got to continue to share the ball, but space, meaning adjust our positioning, right? We might have to cut or dance. We might have to move to an open area so we're not three in a row. And that's where more of the conceptual stuff or the actions like you talked about, your flank and burn, would come in for us.
Yeah. Really good. I think another way for coaches to think about the dichotomy or the shift between man offense and zone offense, in line with what you just said, is against man, you're hunting double and triple gaps. And that's where you're creating your advantages. Those don't exist in a zone. That's why it's a zone.
Yeah, here's why. Because if you cut, no one's going to go with you, right? Exactly. You're not going to bring that defender with you to create space.
Exactly. And so, like, as a coach, we must understand that. And if we can help our athletes understand that as well as we do, then you move them from running plays to learning how to play. And they'll be able to get way more creative. And I think that's where there's a big opportunity for coaches is like, okay, now let's run our zone offense. Now let's run our man offense. And you're essentially putting them in those situations, but if they don't understand why, then they're not going to be able to really develop true basketball IQs. Like, they need to understand why that is. And I would guess if I asked all of your players those questions, they wouldn't have the answers to it. And so again, it's not what you know, it's what can you teach. Not all of my players understand that. I need to teach that better as well. So it's an ongoing process. And so for spacing and ball movement against the zone, it's how we then do create what we're trying to get. You just have to do it very, very differently. I'm getting in the chat here, Coach Ryan was talking about how their challenge against a 2-3 zone in playing through the porch was getting trapped in the porch. That's where they actually got in trouble. And so what would you say to a coach that says, okay, yeah, we want to play through this gray area in the short corner or the porch, but we had trouble getting trapped there?
I would say a couple of things. One is look at your positioning in the short corner. Can we take a step out to make that trap a little longer? Two, stay one pass ahead of the defense. So if we are getting trapped there, use that to punish them, right? Get defense in the coverage, punish them for coverage. So if that's what they're going to do, let's punish them for that, because that can actually be an advantage for your offense. Now, you got to be tough. You got to handle the ball. You got to have players that can be available to the ball, but you are bringing two to the ball. So a momentary disadvantage can turn into an advantage and get you in dominoes offensively.
Yeah. Also, put a bigger, stronger, better player in the porch. Your traditional porch player who is just a catcher and finisher in your four out man is not who I would play on the porch against the zone. I would actually suggest moving your dragon player into the porch against the zone. Dragon being, okay, they're our best playmaker that's of larger size. They can see over traps a little bit easier, a little bit better. They usually probably can be trapped by at least one player that's smaller than them, and they're your better decision maker. So I think that's probably the biggest mistake that I see is, okay, we want to play through our primary ball handlers. Against the man, our primary ball handlers are in the action spots that are attacking our double and triple gaps. So that's why we have our rackers and dragons there. But against the zone, we're not going to get that as much. Like, the racker can still get that in transition, maybe. But if we go neutral, we need to actually get our primary ball handler, like our Jokic dragon type, to actually play through the porch. So that would be a very practical adjustment you can make. And if you don't have that type of player, you won't be good against anything anyway. Mark, you had something, I can tell.
Yeah, think of the porch against the zone as a place of attack, not a position. So this is where my porch plays, rather than we attack out of the porch. Who do we want to attack there? So really good adjustment by just putting a better player there. Well, this was fun, man. It's always great to talk hoops with you. Hopefully I served coaches, but I know I learned a lot too. I got 3 pages of notes here. One thing you mentioned was our eyes should light up against the press in a zone. I find those are two blind spots for coaches, which is why we're here. So if we can help you, whether that's coming in and working with your teams on beating pressure or playing against the zone, or our resources in the app, feel free to check those out. Hope this conversation served. And Tyler, anything else before we wrap it up?
We would love to have those of you that are our community members to join Grow to actually talk live with us every Tuesday at 5 p.m. PST. We have our courtside consulting, which is one-on-one conversations like this. We have that founding member offer expiring here in the next 24 hours. So if you are interested in that, reach out to Mark or myself. And we have a couple spots in our Indiana team campus near Chicago. A couple spots available for that left if you'd like to travel your team in. I guess we might be having a team from Alaska travel down to that one as well. So actually the coach whose film we saw today will be our host, Coach Krieger there, will be hosting that team camp. And that would be an incredibly effective way for you to improve your team this summer. So those are ways to stay involved and go deeper with us. Thank you guys for being here. And Mark, always a pleasure. I learned a ton as well.
Yes, sir. Stay savvy.
See y'all.